Available now from Graphic Audio.
Graphic Audio presents DC Comics Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Be careful, Barry.
Don't worry, I'll be right back. My God.
Why am I brought from universe to watch its destruction?
Anyone have any idea what this is about?
I am the Monitor, and I brought you here to save the multiverse.
Only then, in a single, swift, and surprising stroke,
I will kill the man I love.
Damn you! I just wanted to see her one more time!
This is war, Superman.
This ends now!
Why are you fighting me? You're already dead!
I need more power! I need more strength!
Time for you, your world, and your universes to die!
Iris.
Crisis on Infinite Earths and all names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics. Copyright 2009 DC Comics. All rights reserved. And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
There's some kind of trouble at Stack Island.
Ready to initiate bubble bath.
Mutiny. There's been a mutiny. On Copper Mountain.
They've got the orbital station.
We have to get the word out somehow.
Graphic Audio presents The Serrano Legacy by Elizabeth Moon.
Esme's Lisa, it's clear that your ancestors earned the enmity of mine. They massacred the family we were sworn to protect.
Narrated by Nanette Savard. With performances by Mort Shelby, Andy Clements, Elizabeth Demery, Colleen Delaney, Tim Getman, Peter Stray, Dylan Lynch, David Coyne, Eric Messner, Casey Platt, Tom Simpson, Stephen Carpenter, Sherry Simpson, Elizabeth Jernigan, Christopher Graybill, Jonathan Watkins, Lily Beacon, Joe Brack, Tim Carlin, Sonny Lasky, Richard Rowan, Michael Glenn, Kate Foster, James Lewis, Tess Rowan, Ren Casey, Terrence Aselford, Scott McCormick, Ken Jackson, and Michael John Casey. Change of Command, Part 2.
Brun discovered that Kate looked and sounded a lot less Texan when she was detecting. She had acquired copies of all the relevant surveillance materials on the grounds that she needed to prove that the Lone Star Confederation had not been involved in any way. Now her room was festooned with charts and lists and flat-pick blow-ups.
This here is a list of every person registered in the Monos Hotel. I don't think much of your investigations for only getting a list of those on the fifth floor and above. Sure, the shot came from that high, but people can go up as well as down. Now, they know at least one shooter was here in room 517.
They didn't tell us that.
Well, they wouldn't. I wouldn't. If you were back home and I was investigating there, I'd have rules to follow, same as they do. Now, the couple in room 517 wasn't there at the time. They were attending the annual convention of the plumbing contractors, and we have good surveillance pictures of them in their booth for 2 hours, and another two if you don't count the one trip each made to the John. Moreover, there's witness statements and an order book with an automatic timestamp to show they took orders.
They could have let someone else use their room.
Yep. First thing I thought of. But, as it happens, the room door was not unlocked. It was forced. Blown, actually, with a string of DJ-8. Also, someone took the trouble to overpulse the mag relays so that no alarm would sound when the lock blew. They wouldn't bother with all that if they had a key. The Stringholtz might still be involved, but I doubt it. Right now, I'm looking at 8 possibles.
Kate pointed them out on her list.
2 hotel employees, the assistant day manager, and the housekeeping supervisor.
Why them?
Access to files on which rooms were occupied and which rooms were occupied at what times. I don't want to drag you through the gory details, Brun, but look at this here.
Kate put up another screen with the plan of the hotel and street overlaid in colors.
Your security personnel did a pretty good job, even though it wasn't good enough. They moved all known foreigners out of rooms overlooking the route from the court to the palace. They'd put spotters on the roofs and the usual sort of net below. They had roving patrols, including in this hotel. My people might have made some changes, but nothing good enough to keep your dad alive if his route was known. And his route was posted. Everyone knew it. Now I can tell you this much. I'm convinced it wasn't even an outside job. I think it was someone in the Familius who tried to make it look like the new Tex militia.
Well, I want to know who.
You got any ideas? Your population's a lot bigger than ours, and we usually start with some idea of who's trying to kill someone.
Well, there's always my Uncle Hollis, though I don't think he would. He wanted my dad's property, and he's going to do his best to get it away from Mother, as you saw. Then there's his son, Kel, who is meaner than a... What's your term?
Rattlesnake, and...
One of the Consulines, though I can't see Hobart Consuline doing anything that stupid on his own.
If it was stupid, I mean, he did end up speaker. Well, let's go after this another way. Leaving aside the murder for the moment, what else have we dug up?
Kate shoved one mess of papers aside and brought up a printout that looked to Brun like rows of figures.
Are those numbers supposed to mean something?
Quite a bit. If you can follow the money, you can just about always find the criminal. I got these figures off the public news feeds, by the way, so I can't vouch for their accuracy. But here's some things to look at. See this? It's your uncle's shares in companies you told me were your family holdings.
Brun recognized most of the names. Her mother had mentioned them, but had given no details.
Brun, I need to talk to you.
Brun hadn't heard from Lady Cecilia in days, and had been so caught up in Kate's research that she'd almost forgotten about her.
Lady Cecilia, how?
Now.
I have that Lone Star woman visiting.
I know, I heard the rumors. But can I come out for a few days?
Of course.
A few hours later, Cecilia erupted into the house in what Brun recognized as a fine white fury. She didn't even glance at Kate.
Did you know that Kevil Mahoney's been robbed while he was in hospital?
No! George didn't say...
George has been trying to cope without getting them in deeper trouble. Someone swiped their accounts the day of the assassination, though George was too busy to find out about it for a couple of weeks, and he had no way to trace it by then.
But how? I thought the safeguards...
were safe. Yes, so did I. But George is trying to take care of Kevil and finish law school... They can't even afford a cook, and they're going to have to sell the house. The thing is, Brun, George didn't have the access codes, and Kevil couldn't remember them. I have them, but I don't know how to interpret what's in the files.
You have Kevil's access codes?
Yes, and he has had mine.
So what they were saying about you and Kevil...
was idle gossip. Brun, I'm ashamed of you. The man's hurt, his memory's damaged, he's been robbed, and all you can think about is that?
Sorry, it did come to mind.
Cecilia looked at the papers and films spread all over the library tables, and then at Kate.
What were you looking up?
Going through the public financial records, trying to find out how Harless was getting so far with a ridiculous claim, and trying to cross the trail of the killer. Brun's mama's over at Cerealis, doing the same thing.
Brun looked at Cecilia.
Kate, we need to join forces here. With the code Cecilia has and your ability to interpret the files, this might go a lot faster.
If you'll keep intruders out. Remember what I said about your inept security.
I worry more about Kevil. Why don't I go bring him out here?
Excellent idea.
But that's all wrong. That's...
Somebody who'd do all that wouldn't stop at a little shooting.
By the time Brun got back with Kevil Mahoney, Kate and Cecilia were hard at work. Brunn helped Kevil into the library and moved a pile of printouts off a chair for him.
Looks like fun. You must be the Texan.
Ranger Briarly. Just call me Kate. Hoo-wee. Boy, someone sure knocked a hole in your stock tank. But I'll get him.
Kate has a healthy disrespect for thieves.
I don't like people hurting people and taking advantage. Especially of people that's just been blown up. I bet my best show saddle that there's not but one or two villains in this drama. And I aim to catch every one of them.
Brunn held up a sack and shook it.
You'd be interested in what I found at Kevil's, then. Interesting meds to give someone with a brain injury.
I thought so. Was that nurse there? He's been harder to shake with every visit.
Oh, yes. Very eager to give Sir Mahoney a little something to make the trip out here easier. Then very eager to clear the shelves of the meds.
I don't suppose you have his access codes.
When I got back home and wasn't going out much, I spent my time building some of the gadgets Kutsudas has. So yes, an illegal data suck gave me every bit of data on him. Here. Interfaces to the cube reader or the computer, whichever you want.
3 nights later, Brunn was dozing on one of the long leather couches in the library, an arm shielding her eyes from the light, when the breakthrough came. Kate no longer looked like the sexy blonde in red fringe. Back-to-back all-night work sessions had flattened the hair and put circles under her eyes. Instead of the tight red suit, she wore loose-knit pants and shirt. But nothing could dim the grin she turned on the others.
Gotcha. This is it, partners. We've got what we need.
Mm-hmm. Got whom?
Your Uncle Harless, for starters. He's been acquiring stock in ways that are illegal even here. And I have to say, Brunn, that your government needs to overhaul its legal system in a big way. There's holes you could drive a herd of longhorns through with this bylaws arrangement. All you have to have is one generation of idiots, cowards, and a few bad guys, and it'll be all over for you.
Cecilia's rumpled red head rose from the other couch.
Well, that's all very well, but what did he do?
He extorted stock by roughing up some of your weaker relatives. You remember telling me how surprised you were that your dad's Aunt Trima left her stock to Harless? That was no accident. I've got the paper trail where Harless got some local toughs to come in and stomp on some of her favorite china and tell her they'd break her bones just as easy. And he had the police around there in his pocket. Told them she was a crazy old lady who dropped things and had hallucinations.
And they believed it?
Money makes a strong argument. Anyway, that's not all I've got. And the evidence ought to stand up even in a crooked court. Which is what you've got, I gather. Harless contributed quite a bit to the education of certain judges' children. If you've got any kind of an opposition journal, this'll be meat and gravy for him.
I can help write the appeal.
Kevil Mahoney was standing, leaning crookedly against the doorframe.
You're up. You're supposed to be resting.
I've done nothing but rest for weeks. Enough. My memory's still spotty, but if you feed me the facts, I can write. I think.
Good. Then I think it's time for this Texas gal to go have a rest and a shower. Whew, I must look like something the cat dragged in.
Kevil Mahoney's name on the bottom of the petition for summary judgment upholding the late Lord Thornbuckle's will might have had little effect, but the thick stack of supporting evidence had plenty. One of the court clerks called Brunn that very afternoon.
The judge hasn't heard any of this before.
Of course not. Sir Mahoney was critically injured, as you know. Some of the family files were under his personal lock.
Brunn said nothing about Kevil's other problems. A clerk wouldn't have reason to know anything about them.
Is this all the data you have? Or can we expect more?
No, this isn't all. This is merely the preliminary filing. My mother, Lady Thornbuckle, is on Cerealis, getting additional data from the main family archives there.
I see. Well, you'll hear from us.
2 hours later, Harless came storming up the drive, only to be stopped by Brunn's new security force. After they disarmed him and checked with Brunn, they escorted him to the door. Brunn met him there, backed by Kate, Cecilia, and an upright Kevil, who was leaning on George. Kate had reappeared in full Texan persona, But this time, she wore her ranger badge.
Before you say anything, let me make it clear. We have all the evidence we need that you engaged in criminal activity to get control of family companies, and we are gathering more.
I don't believe it. You can't do this to me. I didn't do anything. It was all perfectly legal. Hobart will take care of you.
How very interesting. Hobart. Could you possibly mean Hobart Consuline? Now, why would someone in our sept be working with a Consuline?
I didn't say Consuline, but it's my right.
You had no right to terrify poor old Aunt Trima. And yes, we will press charges.
Brun was startled to realize that she sounded very much like her father, and wondered if the others noticed.
I'll see you in hell!
Harless wheeled and strode down the front walk, shadowed by the guards.
It's not over.
No, but it's a good beginning. Come on, hon. Where do you hear Cecilia's next good idea?
What?
She's found a place for all those inconvenient women and children that Lieutenant Serrano was stuck with. She's going to take them off to a pioneer planet she knows about, where they'll be happier and their skills are needed.
That's nice for Baron and Esme, but I wanted her to go tell my mother what we've accomplished. She needs to know that we have evidence against Harless. We can't trust that to ordinary communications.
You're right, but now that Harless is on the run, there's no hurry, is there? Your mother's not going to do anything rash.
Ruth Ann took a long look out the windows at Exet 24. It looked cool and green, and she didn't know if this was spring, summer, or winter. Puddles reflected the sky, patches of blue and rolls of gray cloud like unspun wool. No towering cities, no noisy crowds. When the hatch opened, the air that swept in was cool, moist. She could smell green growing things on that air. The red-haired woman led the way. Ruth Ann followed close behind. The ground felt good to her feet, even through shoes. The red-haired woman with the fancy name, Cecilia Watsis, a rejuvenant, led the way into a little square building where they each had to show their ID. Ruth Ann felt the oddness of it, that each person handled their own cards, and hers had her own name on it, Ruth Ann Pardue. Once they were all finished with customs, whatever that was, and had new purple stamps on the cards, the red-haired woman led them down the street. This was scary. The little town looked like the backwater village where Ruth Ann had grown up, where she'd have been whipped till her legs bled for walking around wearing shoes and looking at people. But here were men and women, dressed almost decently, except that they all wore shoes, and the women didn't keep their eyes down. People looked at her, but with hope, not distaste. She recognized the admiring glances at the children. They turned into the open doorway of a two-story building.
Ronnie! Raffaella!
Lady Cecilia! Just a second! I'm coming!
A slender young woman with dark hair and eyes came running down and gave the red-headed woman a hug. Then she looked at Ruth Ann.
I've got dinner on. We're so glad you came. I hope you like it here. Ronnie's out trying to see why a machine won't work or something. He'll be back soon. Oh, and I'm Raffaella.
Ruth Ann could see that this woman had never lowered her eyes in respect. She had never stood back keeping silence. She had never been denied access to anything she wanted to learn. But from the smells coming from the kitchen, she had also never learned to do more than push buttons when she wanted something to eat.
And we hope that...
What were you trying to cook?
Oh, just some meat.
Let me take a look.
Ruth Ann sailed into the kitchen on a wave of unexpected delight. Sure enough, the place was a mess. Sticky implements cluttering the counter. And not a big enough counter either. That would have to change. And a stove leaking smoke from a badly hung door.
Secunda... Shelly Marie, you get that counter cleared. Terry, get this floor clean. Benji...
Her oldest son stared at her wide-eyed.
Benji, we need that stove fixed.
Mama?
Now, Benji. Simplicity, honey, you take the littles out into the garden. You do have a garden, don't you?
Well, yes, but it's not... it's kind of a mess.
Prima could feel her confidence coming back. Messes she understood. and what to do about them.
Not for long. Simplicity, you just start the littles weeding and make sure nothing bothers them.
The dark-haired young woman was fluttering now like a gaudy butterfly in a net.
But, Sarah, Ruth Ann, I didn't mean for you to go to work. I was making dinner for you.
Never you mind. Why don't you go set that table or something?
The tall, lanky redhead led the younger woman away.
Come on, Rafa. I'll explain about Ruth Ann.
In a kitchen again, at last. A real kitchen. Too small by far for all of them, but bigger than any of the cubbyholes called kitchens in the spaceships and space stations. Ruth Ann looked around for a work table. None. It would have to be the counter, where Shelley swept aside the clutter to make room for her, then began rummaging in drawers for the knife she knew Ruth Ann would want.
We're going to need a work table, Benji. They said they had plenty of wood, so that's something to start planning.
Once out of the kitchen and into the adjacent dining room, Rafa finally ceased to flutter and settled into exhaustion.
Oh, Cecilia, I feel terrible, but the twins kept me up last night.
You haven't found anyone to take them?
No, we sort of decided to keep them ourselves.
You? Do you think that's wise?
You mean we'll run mine when she finds out? I don't think she will, but if she does, too bad. I quite understand her not wanting to keep them. It must have been horrible, and I wish it had never happened. But I love the boys, and I even love it that they're part of her. The way things are, Ronnie and I may never get off this planet again. And that's all right, but I do miss some things.
My dear, you don't have to stay here.
Yes, we do, and don't argue. We wanted a life of our own, and we're getting it. It's not anything I imagined, but whether you believe it or not, we're happy. But the thing is, children, it'll be years because, well, I don't fancy having babies without modern medical support. This way we're helping Bron and ourselves.
What did you name them?
Oh, the redhead's Peter for Ronnie's great-uncle, and the brown-haired one, Salomar, for my mother's brother.
Cecilia felt her eyes stinging unexpectedly. Family names, and names she must know were in Brun's family line as well.
So, when do I see the little demons?
They're napping. They've had some illness. I know it's only a childhood thing, and all children do this. Out here, I mean.
Well, we'd better set the table then. One thing I found out about Ruth Ann, when she makes up her mind, things get done.
Was she one of the ones who hurt Bron?
No. Her husband was, but she knew nothing about it until long afterwards. Where's your table linen?
He used it for crib sheets. All we can do is dust this off.
This had been an elegant dining table when Rafa and Ronnie brought it downside, but it had spent several years as a work surface and looked it. Cecilia forbore to comment on the state of the floor. With no glass in the windows, let alone any household machinery, how could Rafa keep the dust off the floor? And helped wipe down the scarred tabletop. Rafa unlocked the big cupboard in the corner and took down stacks of plates.
I still have most of the china, even if they look a bit silly on this bare wood.
Incongruous was the right word, but Cecilia said nothing, laying out Pierce and Samuelson's famous coronation pattern with the gold wavy rim. Partway through, she noticed that the smell from the kitchen had changed from singed meat and something sour to a delicious blend of roast and something that almost smelled like bread. Suddenly, Ruth Ann appeared in the doorway.
Oh, you don't use tablecloths?
We don't have any left. We had to use them for the beds.
Deary me. And us with all more than enough in the luggage. Cecilia, where are the boxes? Do you know?
No, but I'll find out. Which box?
The one with the table and chair on the side.
Cecilia headed for the shuttle, and from the piles of boxes being unloaded, located the one with the table and chair on the side. One of the crew carried it back for her. She set it on the table and opened it carefully. Inside, it was stacked full of folded linens, brilliant with hand embroidery. Cecilia lifted out the folded cloth.
However did you have time to weave this?
Oh, that's not our weave. We had no space for looms. But Prima, Ruth, Says we mustn't be idle. She got that Miss Waltraud to get us some cloth, and we embroidered it. Do you think it's good enough?
Cecilia shook out the folds. On plain white cloth, the women had embroidered a broad band of flowers, trees, birds, stars, and what she supposed were religious symbols.
It's more than good enough.
It was splendid, and the coronation pattern looked even better than it had before. By this time, the kitchen smells had attracted the twins from upstairs.
Mommy.
The twins were much more mobile than before, and although they might have been sick the day before, they were full of life now. They made straight for the table, and Raffaella tried to intercept them. Terry grabbed Salomar just as Rafa caught Peter.
What big boys! Yours, ma'am?
Oh. Yes, but I'm not ma'am. Just call me Rafa. If you could help keep them off of the dinner table.
I'll take them out in the garden and help Simplicity keep an eye on them.
When Tertia had gone, Cecilia cocked an eye at Rafa.
They'll never believe you bore those children, you know. They'll realize they're adopted.
Yes, but not from whom?
Cecilia dared a peek into the kitchen. The floor could not gleam, being what it was, but it had the look of a floor that would gleam if only it were smooth enough. Ruth Ann worked a great lump of dough on the counter, which did gleam, except where she worked. One of the women was washing dishes, another was chopping something that smelled good. Older children were moving in and out, bringing bits of fresh greenery from the garden, carrying out trash, and, as soon as Rafa agreed, mopping the dining room floor. The lights came back on just before Ronnie came through the door.
My God!
The women bowed their heads and waited.
I mean, it's a surprise.
Ruth Ann looked up.
We don't take the name of the Lord in vain. We thought you were going to pray.
I know. What did you do? Where did all this come from?
It's just food.
It's not just food. It's a feast.
Then you can say thanks to God for it.
Ruth Ann looked hard at Ronnie, who reddened.
Oh, right. God is great, God is good, and we thank him for our food.
Amen.
The roast fell into even slices, perfectly cooked. Puffy rolls as light as clouds. Potatoes crisp outside and mealy inside. Fresh greens that weren't bitter or too sour.
Oh, truly a feast. I can't imagine how you got that horrid old stove to work. Ever since the electric went bad, we've all been stuck. The bread machines don't work.
You don't need machines to make bread.
I do. I don't know how to make it otherwise. I tried to put the ingredients in a bowl that the directions say to put in a bread machine, but it came out the most horrible sour lump.
Did you knead it enough?
Knead? I mixed it up. Isn't that what the machine does?
Ruth Ann shot Terry a look.
I don't mean to make fun.
You can make all the fun you want if you'll teach me how to cook the way you do. If I could make an edible loaf of bread just once.
You don't make good bread by making it once. You make good bread by making a lot of bread.
Well, here I am, ready to learn.
Ruth Ann remembered Hazel and had her doubts. This woman was much older than Hazel, and unless she had a natural knack, she might never be very good. Still, she could certainly learn not to stuff too much fuel in a leaky oven and burn a roast on one side. After dinner, the junior wives organized cleanup without even being told, and Ruth Ann discussed with Raffaella why they'd come and what they wanted to do.
We can use all the instruction you can give us. I told Lady Cecilia last time she was here. We have good, hard-working people, but none of us have ever done without electricity or running water or all the other things that we have on developed worlds. It's not just me. It's all of us, just about. We can't learn all this out of books or teaching cubes.
Let's start with you, then. There's room in this house. We can experiment.
Ruth Ann was proud of using that new word, of being able to think of it.
When we know what you need, we'll know what the others need.
The next day, work began in earnest. Ruth Ann had a clear picture in her mind of what the kitchen needed to be so she and the others could work there without falling all over each other. She couldn't believe it. She was directing men.
Make the counter this long.
And they made it that long. They didn't seem to mind, and she was enjoying it. So were the others. All those months of being told how backward they were, all those months of being confused by the humming machines, feeling awkward and uncertain. And now,
if you arrange your bed so the tall plants don't shade the low ones, you'll get more yield. See? You've got them crossways. If the plant rows went the other direction...
Oh, well, look, Becky, why don't you tell me how it should be, and I'll draw a plot of it for next season's planting.
Fine.
Terry had gone upstairs to work on the bedrooms. Although they'd slept last night, Ruth Ann had been very aware of the clutter and dust. The boys were at work in the front courtyard on simple furniture, rope-strung bunks to get them all up off the floor. When Ruth Ann looked out the tall dining room windows, she saw a crowd of men standing watching. It was backwards, men learning from boys, but it was right that the boys and men were together. She carefully ignored the two women wearing pants in the same group. By dinner time that day, the shuttle had brought the rest of their things down from the spaceship, including the pop-up cots Lady Cecilia had bought. The whole house smelled different, and Ronnie had the expression Ruth Ann liked to see on the head of a household. Of course, he wasn't her husband. She kept reminding herself of that. But she did enjoy watching a man eat with relish. Cecilia left a few days later. Ruth Ann hardly noticed. She had her work table in the expanded kitchen, and she had also set up a summer stove outside for preserving. Rafa watched the crowd around the stove as Shelley demonstrated jelly testing.
What we need is a school, a really big kitchen where everybody could come to learn cooking, and maybe a sewing room where they could learn sewing.
A weaving shed. That fabricator cloth is too harsh. And a really big bread oven.
Rafa looked around.
This would almost work if Ronnie and I moved into one of the smaller houses.
No. Your husband's the governor. You need this house. We'll build one.
More quickly than even she had hoped, the school went up. The engineering cubes Cecilia had brought and the bundles of reinforcing whiskers made it possible to pour solid walls quickly. One of the other colonists, who had been a hobby potter on her homeworld, found a lens of good clay in the riverbank and knew how to make tiles. The school was the first building to have locally made tile floors. A proper school for proper women, with a kitchen in which they could all learn the way Ruth Ann had learned, from watching and doing, and being knocked on the knuckles with a wooden spoon when they needed it. A big outdoor oven to handle dozens of loaves of bread at once. A weaving shed. She regretted the loss of the captive women who had been such talented weavers, but Tertia Crockett, she used Anna now, was almost as good. Sunrooms for embroidery, gardens for the children. The gardens for the children produced another benefit. Everyone in the colony wanted their youngest children there, under Simplicity's gentle guidance, for part of the day. Rafaela brought her twins when she came to learn cooking, and the other women copied her. As Ruth Ann had suspected, Rafaela would never be more than a middling baker. Her hand was too heavy for pastry, and not firm enough for yeast dough, though both her pie crusts and bread were now at least edible. But the other women followed her lead, and the gardens were full of busy little children. A few of the other former wives were being courted by men whose wives had died, but enough of the women wanted no part of remarriage that she was sure of enough teachers for years to come. Ruth Ann's daughters had suitors too, the older ones. And her sons, about whose acceptance she had been so worried, were every one of them more expert at tool use than these city folks. For all that those men had taken courses and been passed as expert enough, they may have been, Ruth Ann thought, with the fancy electric tools they'd trained on, but few of them knew anything of unpowered tools. Everything from beds and tables to bowls poured out of the boys' workshop. Nobody minded that it was plain stuff, though one of the other colonists began making stains out of local plants to give the wood different tones of soft red and yellow. And nobody here minded if a few girls took up woodcrafting. all through the rest of that spring and into this new world's long summer, Ruth Ann blessed the long series of chances that had brought them here. Ronnie had taken to coming by to fetch the twins, and he often stopped to chat, leaning on one of the planters.
I never thought 19 women and a bunch of children could make this much difference. You've galvanized the colony, is what you've done. The extra supplies help, but it's you, Ruth Ann, you and the rest of them who've waked us up and gotten us moving.
Ruth Ann glanced sideways at him, thinking that he hadn't learned at all yet, even so. Greatly daring, but also confident, she reached to the basket of hand tools, handing him a weeder and nodding to the planter he leaned on.
While you're resting.
You never do stop working, do you?
You don't have to rush if you don't get behind. Those stickery ones are the weeds.
Yes, ma'am. I'll learn in the end.
Ruth Ann found it easier to bring up what she wanted to ask Ronnie when he was bending over the tangled growth, weeding.
By the way, those twins of yours, I can't believe you're Raphael aboard them. She's so tiny.
Ronnie's ears turned redder.
She didn't. They're adopted.
It doesn't matter to God. What it is, though, and I know I'm being presumptuous, but that Salomar, he reminds me of someone.
The back of Ronnie's neck went three shades darker, not counting the sunburn.
Who?
I'm thinking.
Ruth Ann folded her needle away because her hand had started shaking.
I'm thinking he reminds me of Mitch. And I'm thinking, if there's any reason he should mind me of Mitch, that you might be worrying that I'd notice. You've been awful good to us, and I don't want to worry you. So if it is that, what I'm thinking of, then I want you to know that I don't mind. And I'm glad to have the boy around, both of them.
Ronnie's shoulders bunched.
I won't say any more.
Ronnie turned around. His eyes were bright with unshed tears.
It's all right. We didn't know you were coming, but... Oh, I'm making a mess of this. Rafa will kill me. But if you've guessed, you've guessed.
I bore 9 of that man's children. I know their stamp.
Ruth Ann said nothing of Peter's father, though she knew exactly who that red hair reminded her of.
Brun wanted a good home for them. She was afraid they might be stolen away and used against her.
Ruth Ann still could not understand a woman not clinging to her own flesh and blood, but she wasn't going to argue that now. If their mother had been a natural mother, she herself wouldn't have this chance.
You don't have to defend her to me. You don't know what a blessing it is to have those children here. I've worried and worried. That's the last bit of Mitch I'll ever see. And I wanted to know the children were safe. Will Raphaela mind? I'm not going to interfere, I promise you.
She'll skin me, but she'll hug you. Ruth Ann, you are a very, very unusual lady.
I try to be a good woman.
Ruth Ann felt a bubble of delight that would not be denied. She stood up and let her head fall back.
Praise God you aren't angry with me for seeing what I saw, and you won't keep me from him. I never thought to be happy again, and here I am, happier than I've ever been.
Confession, for a member of the Order of Swords who had been on a mission, must always be to a priest of the Order. Even so, there were things no one confessed, not if he wanted to live. The priests had the right, ecclesiastical and legal, to mete out punishment, including death. Hostite Fiedi knelt in silence, awaiting the priest's arrival, and thought about what he had to confess and what he had to conceal. As a young man, he had found distinguishing between debriefing and confession very difficult, but now it was second nature. Hostite began the old, familiar ritual.
Forgive me, Father, for
even as his voice continued the opening phrases, his mind was dividing, as sheep from goats, the truths he must repent from the other truths of which he must not repent, as long as he was a swordmaster.
It has been a long time.
I was on a mission to distant worlds.
Beyond the Church's dominion?
Nothing is beyond the Church's dominion. But this was far from any priest of the Order of Swords.
Ah. Go on, then.
Category by category, Hastite laid his soul's burden out. The temptations acted upon, and those merely dwelt upon in the mind. The orders followed, which ought not to have been followed, and the opposite. He was heartily sorry for them all, for the necessities which his duty placed upon his conscience, when he would have been happy to live in peace all his days, with no more to confess than a lustful glance at someone's daughter.
And have you any other sins? Lust, perhaps?
They always asked about lust, though by now they should know that his conditioning had destroyed that possibility. He answered as always, and as always received his penance in true submission of spirit. When he was too old to be of service, when the Master of the Order of Swords commanded, he would confess the last of his sins and go to his death clean-hearted, no longer the shadow of the dancers, but filled with light. So it had been promised him, and so he believed. There was no other life but this possible, and no other future to which he belonged.
Hastite!
The Master's call brought Hastite out of the reverie which a long penance produced. He rose smoothly from his knees and turned.
My lord.
The chairman would like an expansion of your report on the situation in the Familius.
My lord.
We will be granted an audience this afternoon. I will accompany you, as will Iagen Perseus.
Perseus, another who had recently completed a mission in the Familius. Hastite was elder by 3 years, but he knew Perseus as a competent agent.
You will report to the Order's clothier for a fitting now.
Yes, my lord.
Hastite bowed. The Master withdrew from the chapel, and Hastite made his way to the storerooms in which the Order kept all the costumes its members might need. He did not dwell upon the afternoon's meeting. Rumor had many things to say about audiences with the chairman, but Hastite had been there before, and in any case feared nothing, including death. The costume appropriate for a swordmaster in this instance was simple enough. The bodysuit of black stretch knit fit like skin, and incidentally left no space for hidden weapons. The scarlet velvet cap matched scarlet velvet slippers and denoted his swordmaster rank. Looped through the shoulder epaulets were cords of gold, green, and red silk. The level of experience, the number of assassinations, domestic and foreign. The whole story of his career, if one knew how to read it. And the chairman certainly did. As he was checking the fit of the slippers, Iagen Perseus came in. He nodded, but did not speak. Hastite nodded in return. They could not discuss their missions until after the report to the chairman, lest they be suspected of colluding in some error. From then until lunch, Hastite reviewed his debriefing cube, correcting minor errors in transcription with a coded data wand. 4 seats down, Perseus was doing the same thing. At lunch, they ate at different tables in the order mess. Hastite restricted himself, as his penance required, to clear soup and water with a lump of sinner's bread, a hard, sour, unleavened lump that offered just enough nourishment to ensure that the penitent could perform any necessary duty. Outside the chairman's office, the Master of the Order of Swords handed his red cut velvet cloak to the gray-uniformed guards and unbuckled his sword belt. Hastite wondered why the Master was required to wear a full dress and then relinquish the cloak and swords, but he pushed the question aside. Tradition required it, that was all. He and Perseus doffed their velvet caps for inspection, then put them back on. The chairman sat behind his great black marble desk, his face reflected dimly in its gleaming surface. On either side, his personal guards.
Fiedi, you were sent to see the Barraclofs. What then did you find?
Hastite bowed, then began his recital, carefully gazing at the bronze plaque on the wall behind the chairman's head.
This was my third visit to the Barraclof senior branch, in the persona of a saber dance troop's visiting instructor. On my fourth day there, the assassination of Lord Thornbuckle was reported. The dance troop is comprised of locals. Their reactions indicated that they were aware of friction between Lord Thornbuckle and his younger brother, and between Thornbuckle and certain families. The Consuline Moraline Sept in particular.
Did you have speech with family members?
I gave private lessons to 6 family members while there, including Stefan, the present head of the family, Mirren, his wife, Rudolf and James, his sons, Catherine his daughter, and Viola his niece. Stefan spoke only of the art of fence. Mirren expressed the opinion that Lord Thornbuckle's death was a dreadful nuisance, but that he had brought it on himself, and she hoped that the new Texan assassins would be satisfied with one death.
How does she fence?
With that same wit. She answers a threat well enough, but always directly. She cannot see beyond the next thrust. Most women of the seated families are more astute.
And the others?
Rudolph prefers Parpon. He fences only because it is done in his set, and is content with mediocrity.
His mother's son. Go on.
James competes in school tourneys. He seeks praise from me when I visit. He may mature into a good fencer someday.
Weapon?
Épée, I think, though perhaps saber later.
Continue.
Catherine and Viola both fence well, for women.
You have no more to say about them?
No. They fence because it is done, as they play at nets or ball or swim.
Are they pretty, Fiedi?
Hostite cast his mind back. He could see the faces clearly, but he had no grasp of what the chairman's standard of beauty was.
They are young and rich. They are not dancers.
Your standards are strict, I see. Well then, Jagen Perseus, you were sent to the Consulines. What did you find?
Hobart Consline continues in his belief that he is ill-treated. Although he's now the acknowledged head of that family in Sept, he still hungers after the approval he feels was given his brother. He is ambitious for himself and his friends. He wants to ensure his secure hold on power for the rest of his life.
And he is a rejuvenant?
Yes, a multiple. He despises the short-lived who cannot afford rejuvenation.
And does he know where the compassionate hand stands on rejuvenation?
He does, sir. And he says it is the one weakness of the compassionate hand.
His religion?
He has no belief in any higher power than wealth and influence, sir.
Ah. Such men are ripe for superstition. Hostite, how about the Barraclough's?
Some in the family are believers, but not in our faith.
How stand the Barraclough's on rejuvenation?
Most of them over 40 have been rejuvenated, sir, but several of the seniors have refused. The Barraclough family has an elective power structure. Stefan, the current head of family, is not actually the eldest son of eldest sons. His older brother, Victor, specialized in legal theory, and he refused rejuvenation. His objection was legal, the turmoil that would be caused by multiple rejuvenations. Victor is now in his 70s. Victor's daughter, Vivienne, was rejuvenated with the new process at 40. She is now 45, but my sources say that she is determined not to repeat the process. Stefan is 57 and has received two rejuvenations, giving him an apparent age of 30. However, he disapproves of what he calls frivolous rejuvenations.
For either of you, to what extent do the non-family citizens of the Familias regard rejuvenation as a legal or social or religious matter?
Because Hobart Consline is so willing to talk, more willing to talk than almost anything else, I have data on these points. He is worried about opposition to serial rejuvenation. This is fueled by two concerns. First, the profit margin. Consuline Sepp's family investments in rejuve pharmaceuticals are large, and until the Patchcock scandal, these had formed 20% or more of the profits. Second, he is concerned about the social constraints that might be put on serial rejuvenants. The Consulines introduced and strongly supported the repeal of the law against repeat rejuvenations. He feels that serial rejuvenation, conferring unlimited lifespan, is the earned right of those who have shown their fitness by accumulating the wealth to afford it.
Ah. And would he apply this same philosophy to foreign affairs?
In all likelihood. He follows up advantages in fencing, and, from what I've been able to gather, in other domains as well, with great vigor and intensity. I have observed him at table and with his family, and would say that nothing is ever enough for him. If he had no access to rejuvenation and advanced medical care, he would eat and drink himself into the grave.
Truly, the discipline of the faith saves more than souls.
The chairman flashed a smile at Hostite. The chairman, as lean and fit at 60 as he had been 30 years earlier, had not been rejuvenated and would not be. The church forbade it. But neither would he inflict damage on his own body for selfish purposes.
So, Hobart Consuline, who has become the new head of government, is a man of grudges and jealousies, scheming and ruthless, a man who will not feel safe until he controls everything. What, Hostite, will the Baraklovs do when he tries to control them?
Victor will fight with all the legal knowledge he has, but the Familia's Regnant has no formal constitution. Stefan will start by hoping for the best, but if Hobart angers him sufficiently, he will lead his family in opposition. He is not a man of great vision, however. He counters the obvious attack, but does not see the oblique one that covers.
Why, I wonder, did they elect him head of the family?
Of the possibilities, he seemed least likely to interfere with the others' lives. Lord Thornbuckle was already speaker, in any case. He did not want the family leadership as well. His younger brother, Harless, was not well-liked. Victor didn't want it. And although the Familias is far from strict on the gender issue, few of the great families have women at the head. None of the Baraclough women were dissatisfied enough to make a run for it.
They have no renegade women?
They do, but their tastes run to inconsequentials. Lady Cecilia de Marctos, for instance, breeds horses.
She was on Xavier.
The chairman's cold contempt almost loosened Hostite's bowels. He should have known that. He had been listening to what her family said about her.
She might be just a horse breeder, but she has been inconveniently near several disturbances in our plans. She was on Cerealis when Lepescu was destroyed.
Lepescu was ours?
The chairman gave Iagan a look Hostite would not like to have received.
No. I would not use that filth. It is one thing to kill, even to maim as a lesson, but quite another to treat an enemy as less than human. No, what I'm remembering is that Cecilia de Marctos was the one who took the crown prince back to his father and meddled. I did not authorize our agent's attack on her. Women are simply not reliable, and I suspect personal jealousy of some sort. But she showed up again interfering with the Patchcock situation. It passes chance that she, a woman never previously far from a horse, should be right at the scene of problems so many times.
Harris Serrano. The commander was there also.
Yes. And the Serranos have always had the reputation for neutrality in the Familias. Here they are linked to a Baraclough repeatedly.
Harris Serrano had resigned her commission. She began her association with Lady Cecilia as a hireling.
Easy enough to contrive that if one wanted to form a duetto.
A bonded pair hunting together, that meant.
Thank you both. Master, if you will wait a moment.
Hostite backed away from the chairman's desk until he felt the ridge in the carpet that signaled the correct distance, then turned to go. Somewhat to his surprise, he lived to cross the threshold. He and Iagan strolled back to the vesting room. The chairman eyed the Master of Swords.
Hostite is our oldest swordmaster, is he not?
Yes, sir.
Unusual for a swordmaster to live this long. And yet, extraordinary, would you say?
In his way, yes.
Yet,
I cannot warm to him, Chairman.
No, and that is why I insist he has not reached his end. I must have one swordmaster whom the Master of Swords does not like.
The Master bowed. They both knew this. They had said it before.
I find the news of Hobart Consuline disturbing, however. Such a man might do anything if he felt endangered. We thought the discovery that their rejuvenation drugs were so easily contaminated would slow down the rate of rejuvenation. Why would someone risk insanity, senility, just for the chance of unending life?
Because they fear death?
It is not just that. They do it when they are years from death, just for pleasure. They do not want eternal life. They want eternal youth. That is not the same.
No, Chairman.
We did not realize that at first. It poses a great problem for us. The strategy which we prepared for one situation may be useless in another.
The chairman turned to look out the window. He had a terrible vision of Hobart Consuline as he appeared in the data cubes, still spoiled and smug 100 years hence, when he himself was dead and in his grave. It would not do. He must find a solution, and soon. his family, his vast, extended family, the entire benignity of the Compassionate Hand, relied on him to keep them safe and prosperous and orderly. It was his duty, and he was chairman precisely because he had never yet failed in his duty.
I may need to speak to Hostide Fieri again. Please have him remain in the compound. I also need your analysis. Is there anyone in the seated families who has refused serial rejuvenation? And if so, why? Are there any sane members of their council?
Yes, Chairman.
When the Master of Swords had gone, the chairman turned to look out the window again.
Aging children. Senile children. If a merciful God limits the number of rejuvenations with even the best drugs... Terrible prospect. That great empire full of aging, senile children. And in the interim, all that energy and expertise. Their great space navy with admirals wiser than mine. Replenished constantly by commanders wise as admirals. But not enlisted personnel. At least we took care of that. Still, a grave, very grave situation.
He would have to pray for Hobart Consuline. He would have to pray a very special prayer for the soul of Hobart Consuline. And for the soul of Hostite Fieri, it might be. In the boardroom, the chairman faced his board and explained what he had learned.
So the familiars will be in even more turmoil?
And even more acquisitive. I have the Master of Swords looking into the possibilities of a coup d'etat, but we will need a suitable successor.
With due respect, Chairman, I thought our policy was to promote addiction.
You misunderstood. We promote no vices. We do profit from them where faulty human nature allows them to flourish. But in this case, it was my most earnest hope that they would withdraw the drugs, either voluntarily, from shame, or involuntarily, as the evidence of the danger spread. We did not object to the damage done to their military, of course, but that damage was intended to shift their policy away from that process to a safer, more limited drug, which merely prolonged life a decade or so.
Our resources
are unequal to full-scale war with the familiars, yes. We lost an entire assault group at Xavier, and another such loss would be unprofitable. We need a way to protect ourselves without risking ourselves.
To eliminate Hobart Consuline.
That's one possibility, certainly. Especially if the right man can be found to take his place. Someone who understands that unlimited expansion brings explosive decompression in the end.
His board looked back at him. He knew what they were thinking, and knew that they knew he knew. 100, 1,000 stalks of wheat fall before the reapers, and no one knows one from another but the Almighty. But the fall of a great tree brings down those around it and shakes the very ground. Perhaps God cared as much for a blade of grass as for a tall cypress, but mere humans noticed one more than another. It was his decision, but on them would fall the consequences. Miranda walked down the hill to the stables in a chill evening drizzle that did nothing to cool her anger at the dapper little man who had been so sure of his welcome. She had tried to be fair. She had tried to be reasonable. She had told herself that Cecilia often got things wrong in her hot-headed enthusiasms. But Pater Origuemos seemed determined to push her past her limits. He had written, expressing his delight in his ministry. He had written again, complaining of her daughter's interference in foreign affairs, when Brunn had invited that Texas woman to be her guest at Appledale. He had called by Ansible to insist that she be fair to Harless, because, he explained, she didn't really need all that property. He could provide for her and advance her interests himself as Minister of Foreign Affairs. And today he had arrived at Cerealis, smugly certain that he was telling her what she did not already know when he brought the results of the judgment for Bunny's will and against Harless. Smugly certain of his welcome. Smugly certain that he could comfort a widow he was sure needed comforting. If only he had let her alone. She glanced around and saw only the grooms busy with the last evening chores. They nodded to her, and she to them, as she ducked into the passage between the stable offices and the vet supply storage. No one would be surprised to see her here. She often came down for evening rounds, or after, with a few sugar cubes for Bunny's favorite mounts. If only he had left her alone, she would have done nothing. If only he had not flaunted his power, his connections, and hinted so broadly at his involvement that she could not ignore it.
What does he think? That I've always loved him secretly? That I was hoping to slough off an unwanted husband and take a lover? Is he really such a fool?
She opened the door of the old smithy where bits and stirrups and buckles waited for repair. Above the long counter with its burners and torch tips, bottles of chemicals in neat racks. A small forge filled the end of the room, which had been built around it when the new smithy, much larger and suited to a stable with more horses, had been built in the other courtyard. Brunn's information had been more complete than Cecilia's. Pater was linked to the Rejuvenants and to Hobart Consoline. But while Hobart had refused to intervene to protect Harless's interests, he would not cooperate in his own downfall. Neither Brunn nor that Texan Ranger thought that the evidence they had would stand up, since the Speaker could dismiss and appoint ministers and higher court justices at will.
I'm sure Pater planned it. I'm sure he hired the killers, though Cecilia says he could not have done it himself. He was in Zenebra. Kate thinks she's found a money trail, a tenuous one, but in a hostile court it probably would not hold. But whether he did it on his own as a way of currying favor with Consoline or on Hobart's orders, we can't determine. The reward seems to indicate a payment for services rendered. Why else would anyone appoint Pater to foreign affairs? But we can't prove it. Unless you've uncovered something in the archives, we're at a standstill.
The archives had thoroughly implicated Harless Thornbuckle and his son Kel in financial chicanery, extortion, and intra-family power plays, but not in the death of his brother, and not in connection with the Rejuvenants. At least, not that she'd found yet. Miranda moved about the room, then picked up a broken snaffle and sat down at the workbench. Was she sure in her own mind that Pater had had Bunny killed?
Yes.
Was she sure in her own mind that he could not be brought to justice?
As long as Hobart Consoline is Speaker and Pater his Minister of Foreign Affairs, yes. Who would believe the hysterical accusations of a grieving widow?
She could do nothing about Hobart Consoline, the ultimate enemy, the one who, she was sure, had inspired Pater to his actions, whether or not he had ordered them. But here, in her own house, she could deal with his minion. She turned on the smaller torch and played it over the bit in the clamps. She had first learned to work metal as a hobby, when she'd wanted a particular style of guard on her foil. Over the years, she'd learned how to make metal stronger or weaken it, how to make it look old, how to make it look like something else entirely.
You may not approve, my love, but you will understand.
She hoped her children would. Finally, Miranda turned the torch off and left the bit to cool. She had not mended it properly, but she had made a start. That was sometimes the best a person could do. Neil waited by the outer gate.
Good night, Neil. I made rather a mess in the old forge. That broken Sims bit. You were quite right, the little torch isn't hot enough.
It'll come right in the end.
Miranda hoped it would. She would do her best to see that it did. Beata Soren, head teacher for the Little Lambs class of Shepherd's Glen Primary School of Baskar Station, led the way to the transit station. Every few steps, a quick glance behind showed her the neat crocodile of uniformed students, assistant teachers, and volunteer parent helpers. The adults wore an official tabard with Shepherd's Glen Primary School on the left and a picture of a gambling lamb on the right. In the pockets were their official IDs, their locator chips, their emergency kits. Around each adult neck, a lanyard and whistle to supplement the earpiece and mic. And the assistant teachers wore, as she did, an adult version of the school uniform, white shirt and plaid slacks. She herself held the braided end of the organizing ribbon, to which each child was supposed to cling. So far, they all had their little hands on it, but they were still almost in sight of the school. They could still be sent back to spend a boring day in the nursery class. At the station, she handed in the school's credit cube, and the file of 17 children and 10 adults moved into the loading area. This early in the trip, the children were still behaving well, though her experienced eye recognized that Poro Orinos already needed to use the toilet, and Mercy Lavinum had something sticky in her pocket and on the fingers of her left hand. She detailed her first assistant, Yuri, to deal with Poro's needs, and herself excavated the pocket, wiping Mercy's fingers carefully as she did so. Mercy's mother, it seemed, could never resist sending her youngest out without a personal treat, even when it was strictly forbidden. Yuri came back just in time, and the crocodile edged its way on board the transgrav tram that would take them on a tour all around the station. They had a reserved car, and each child was properly buckled into the seat, a motion sickness patch in place, before the tram slid away from the station, one car entirely full of little lambs and their keepers. Beata had run this same field trip 11 times before. She knew from experience how to plan the route to provide the most in thrills, education, and efficiency. First, the slow part, through the densely populated shopping and residential district.
Look, that's where I live. That's my store. Mommy gets bread there.
Then, as the tram swung away on the first of the transgrav segments, Beata gestured for quiet.
Children, we're going to go oopsie. Everyone remember to breathe and hold on.
The tram gathered speed and the lights blinked three times, a final warning of transition. Safety bars swung down in front of each seat. Beata took this opportunity to insert her earplugs. Then the tram plunged into the dark and Beata's body tried to insist it had just fallen off a cliff. Gravity returned gradually, but not to normal. Heavy cargo, their first stop, maintained only 0.25G. The tram emerged from a dark tunnel into a vast, lighted cavern. Beata flicked out her earplugs with a practiced twitch and picked up her microphone.
Attention, children! This is the cargo servicing area for most incoming shipments. Bri, your father works in heavy cargo, doesn't he?
Bri, halfway down the car on the right, nodded.
Well, this is where he works.
I've been here before. He took me.
Yes, Bri, but the others haven't. Please pay attention. When we come to the station, you'll be able to see, out Bri's side, the exit hatches of the container transport system and the tracks of the transport system itself. If we're very lucky, you'll get to see a line of cargo containers coming through.
The tram slowed for the cargo handler station, and sure enough, huge colored bins butted through the heavy curtains at the hatches and trundled along their assigned tracks.
The optical sensors read the coding on the labels, and there's a cross-check by color coding from another set of sensors. This allows the AI system to route each individual bin where it should go.
Where's my daddy?
Beata should have known. She should have made sure that Bri's father was in sight for this brief stop.
Working somewhere. I really don't know for sure.
There he is!
Beata wasn't at all sure the orange-suited figure running a scanner along the markings on a cargo bin was Bri's father, but if it made him happy, her breath caught. As someone in a tan ship suit stepped out and hit the orange-suited one over the head. The top of the bin lifted, and 4, 8, 12 more tan-suited men crawled out. The orange-suited one lay motionless on the floor.
Somebody hit him! He's hurt! My daddy's hurt!
I'm sure he's not, dear.
Experience made her look quickly out the other side of the car for something to distract the children before her brain had finished processing what she saw.
Look at all the funny little cars they run around on.
It was too late to wish she hadn't done that. because all the children except Bri had turned obediently and had a clear view of the firefight as the passengers on the funny little cars attacked first the workers on the floor and then drove right up to the tram. The other adults stared at Beata with white faces.
Now, children, there's nothing to cry about. Just a little bump. Stay seated, please. Mag, would you help Bri calm down? And CV, you see to Crowder.
The adults responded, and by the time the man with the obvious weapon opened the car door, the children were all sitting quietly, listening to Beata tell the story of the brown bunny and the spotted snake.
Oh, shit! There's children on this tram!
We don't use that sort of language.
Beata recognized the man's accent from newscasts over the past 2 years. The muzzle opening on his weapon looked big enough to swallow the tram, but she made herself look at his face.
Please do not upset the children.
Just stay there.
The man backed out. Beata had no intention of doing anything else.